Well, I don't know how you felt as that passage was read. Depending on who you are in the room, I guess a variety of responses. And the more contentious parts of it, particularly chapter 3, we will get to. In fact, what we're going to do is, after I've preached, we're going to have a time to talk together about how we're responding to the text, and then have some opportunity for questions and discussion and that kind of thing. So be ready for that. That would be good for us to help each other puzzle out some of these things. There's some difficult calls that Peter makes to us. But I want to start by saying that it's just generally true, isn't it, that as a culture, I think I've said this a few times in this series already, but as a culture, we're not very good at disagreeing with each other. We're not very good at all. Only a passing glance at Facebook or Twitter, for example, during the election is enough evidence that we're rubbish, aren't we, at disagreeing with people or treating well people that disagree with us. It seems normal, particularly in political discourse, that if you disagree with someone, then that person is, sets them up to be mocked or ridiculed or ignored, or certainly for some to maybe to even have the whip removed in Parliament if you're a politician of a particular persuasion. And that sort of attitude, that disdain for people that are different, that disagree with us, it's certainly been reinforced by mainstream media, but particularly, I think, social media. And as Christians, we're no better. We're no better. We join in with the same slander and reviling, and it happens in all sorts of different ways. And our problem, I think, might be that last week we saw in chapter 2, verse 9, look down at chapter 2, verse 9, Peter's told us who we are. He says, you're a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession. And we can sometimes look at the unbelieving culture that doesn't believe the things that we believe and turn our noses up at them. To be dismissive of them, to be hostile towards them, to join in the kind of language that we might see on Facebook or Twitter, reviling, slander, malicious talk, that kind of thing. But Peter wants us to not do that. Peter's readers were a group of people who were facing hostility for their trust in Jesus. They are a marginalized people. There's some debate about exactly when the letter was written, whether it was under the time of Nero, and so we're suffering horrendously. I've been reading some of the church history around some of the reports of what happened to Christians at that time, and it was particularly horrendous under Nero and other emperors. Or whether it was just before, whether this was written earlier, and it was sort of building up to that intense persecution. And Peter wants to help his Christians, we saw this last week, don't we? Just flick over to chapter 5, verse 12. He wants them to stand fast in the true grace of God. The end of chapter 5, verse 12. Stand fast in the true grace of God. That's what he wants them to do. And the letter is, well, how do you do that? With governments that marginalise or oppress or even persecute you, in the workplace where you're facing hostility for your faith in Jesus and being treated unjustly, in the marriage home where your spouse is unbelieving and undermines your faith, how are you to stand firm? What are you to look like? What are you to wear? What are you to adorn yourself with? That's why I've called this section 2:11 to 3 verse 7 the imperishable beauty of life under the rule of Jesus. The imperishable beauty of life under the rule of Jesus. It comes out in chapter 3 verses 1 to 7 where he's particularly talking to wives in those verses. He talks about putting on this unfading beauty. But I think the imperishable beauty of what those wives are called to is all the way through from chapter 2, verse 11. So I'm going to start there and then we'll get to the more difficult bits in a while. Peter introduces, though, this section in chapter 2, verse 11. Look down at chapter 2, verse 11 with me. Get your noses in the Bible. It would be helpful to do that so you see what I'm saying is what Peter says. Chapter 2, verse 11. Dear friends, I urge you as foreigners and exiles to abstain from sinful desires which wage war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. So straight away, Peter, as he introduces what he's about to say, is saying that the Christian life is lived before two audiences, two people watching you, two groups. As a group who carry a heavenly passport that we learned about in chapter 1, citizens of heaven, those that are God's elect exiles scattered throughout the world. As a citizens who carry an alternative passport to the host culture that they live, they're to abstain from sinful desires, chapter 2, verse 11. He says, beloved friends, cherished friends, not just cherished by me, but cherished by God. That's what we saw in chapter 2, verse 4 onwards, isn't it? The chosen, precious people. So, beloved friends, cherished friends, I strongly urge you, he says. I appeal to you with that identity as God's cherished exiled ones. Abstain from sinful desires. In other words, stay away from the life that lives as though God wasn't really there, that this wasn't your real identity. Abstain, stay away from the desires that spring from self-trust and selfishness and self-obsession. Abstain from the natural leaning of the human heart to live independently of God in his world, pushing self to the center. That's what sinful desires in the Bible are. That's what you're to abstain from. So with this first audience, as God's chosen people before him, you're to avoid going where your natural selfish hearts desire to take you. Don't go there, he says. Recognize, verse 11, that those desires are they're not harmless, they're destructive. They wage war against your soul. They're not natural things to follow. That's what culture kind of says about selfishness and selfish desires, doesn't it? Embrace them because that's who you really are and be free. And Peter says, don't do that. It'll ruin you. Stay away from them. That's the first audience before God. But the second audience is before the world as well, isn't it? Look, live such good lives, he says, verse 12. Such good lives among the non-believing world that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God. Verse 12 It's the positive command to the negative of verse 11. Waging war against selfishness doesn't mean treating the unbelieving world badly. It's the opposite, he says. So for these Christians in Peter's day that he's writing to, as they face pressure from a hostile culture, the temptation is to fight back, isn't it? It's always the temptation. You only have to see Facebook when you get those, I don't know, something about what the government is trying to do that seems to undermine religious freedom or Christianity particularly. Out come the hostile Christians to say how bad the culture is and how we should avoid it and stay away from it and withdraw and condemn it. And Peter says, no, do good. In fact, he'll go on in the rest of chapter 3, 8 onwards, and we'll see this next week. He goes on to say, no, instead of cursing the culture, bless them. It's a wonderful picture of Peter's own story, I think. Do you remember Peter? When Jesus says, Peter, I've got to suffer and die. What does Peter do? He rebukes Jesus, doesn't he? And Jesus has to rebuke him back. Get behind me, Satan, is what he says. You don't have in mind the things of God. Or when Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane and he's sweating drops of blood because he's about to go and face the Father's wrath on behalf of the people that he loves. What does Peter do when the soldiers come to take him? Cuts off the ear of the soldier nearest. Goes to fight. And what does Jesus do? Peter, put your sword away. And then he heals the ear of the soldier. See, Peter says, when the pressure's on to sin, to live selfishly, and that pressure particularly comes when you're opposed, Peter's going to tell us, no, do good, bless, be exemplary. You will suffer for what you believe. You will be marginalized, but your response to that marginalization is to do good. So whereas God's chosen ones, before God, we're to avoid selfishness and living for self. We're to live lives that adorn God, and we do that by doing good to the hostile culture that we live in. Doesn't mean we compromise on what we believe, and we'll think more about this next week, I think. Doesn't mean we assimilate and become like the culture to please them, but we keep seeking to do good as far as we can under God's, with God as our King, even if they're hostile towards us. You see, the temptation for Christians, as we're marginalized, the temptation is always twofold. It's either to withdraw or to assimilate. What do I mean by that? Withdraw, to close our ranks, to keep the bad world out. To use an example, an extreme example, I'm sure, but is the exclusive brethren that we see. No public meetings, very difficult to get along to their events. Everything done in-house, in-house businesses and communities and marriages and all the rest of it. Stay away, hostile culture, is one option. But the other option is to assimilate and just say, well, let's just be like the culture. That would be a way to do good. Let's change what we believe so that they might welcome us. And Peter says, no, don't do that either. He says, we're neither to withdraw or assimilate. No, we live lives honouring God. He's our first and primary audience. But as we do that, we're always striving to do good. Always striving to do good. But specifically then, what does that look like? Well, look down at the passage with me again. Look down at verse 13. I've got a little bit of a thought experiment for you. I'm going to read it again. And just in your head, and I'm going to ask you to answer this question. This will not be rhetorical. what are the repeated phrases or ideas? Okay, dead easy question. Let me read it to us again. Verse 13. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human authority, whether to the emperor as supreme or to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good, you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish people. Live as free people, but do not use your freedom as a cover up for evil. Live as God's slaves. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the family of believers. Fear God. Honor the emperor. Slaves, in reverent fear of God, submit yourselves to your masters, not only as to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh. For it is commendable if someone bears up under the pain of unjust suffering because they are conscious of God. But how is it to your credit if you receive a beating for doing wrong and endure it? But if you suffer for doing good and you endure it, this is commendable before God. To this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin, no deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the cross so that we might die to sins and live for righteousness. By his wounds you've been healed. For you were like sheep going astray, but now you've returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. Wives, in the same way, submit to yourselves to your own husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives. When they see the purity and reverence of your lives, your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as the elaborate hairstyles and wearing of gold or jewelry or fine clothes. Rather, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading or imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. For this is the way the holy women of the past who put their hope in God used to adorn themselves. They submitted themselves to their own husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her Lord. You are her daughters if you do what is right and do not give way to fear. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and heirs with you the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. Okay, repeated themes and ideas. What did you spot? Fear of God. Submission. There are more, but those overwhelmingly are the two big ones, aren't they? Fearing God and submitting to authorities. Just see how consistent fear of God is. For example, verse 13, submit yourselves to the Lord for the Lord's sake. Verse 15, if it is God's will. Verse 16, live as God's slaves. Verse 17, fear God. Verse 18, fear God. Verse 19, commendable because you are conscious of God. Verse 21, you follow in Jesus' steps. What did he do? Well, verse 23, he feared his Father. He entrusted himself into his Father who judges justly. Verse 25, you've returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. Shepherd being someone who takes the reins of your life. Chapter 3, verse 2, unbelieving husbands will see the reverence of your lives, the fear of God in your lives, the reverent fear of the Lord. Verse 4, beauty that is unfeigning is a life of godliness that comes from the imperishable hope of holiness that we see in chapter 1. Verse 4, it's a great worth in God's sight. Verse 5, holy women put their hope in God. Husbands, verse 7, live with the knowledge of their wives who are created by God. That's what the word for translated partner means there. Verse 7, treat them with the same respect because they are co-heirs with you of the eternal life in God. Verse 7, live in a way that won't hinder your prayers, but won't interrupt your relationship with God. Do you see, it's all the way through. God is big. Fear him first. And then similarly, submission. I won't do that again with submission, but it's just, again, all the way through. This idea of putting yourself under the authority of another. And the big example for us is in verse 21 to 25. The Lord Jesus, who put himself under the authority of the Father, even though it cost him his life, so that those others might be rescued. In fact, I think those verses 21 to 25 probably sit right at the center of the whole letter. They shape everything around it. But particularly these verses. So how are we to live before a hostile culture, before a world that doesn't believe what we believe? By fearing God and submitting to the authorities that are over us, any authority that's over us, even if that means suffering unjustly for doing so. See, we tend to live as though people are big, and God is small, don't we? What matters is what people think of me and what the culture thinks of me and not what God thinks of me. But Peter switches it and says, no, when God is big and people are smaller, not small as in insignificant, but small as in their opinion doesn't matter as much as what God thinks of you. So when God is big and people are small, verse 13, as slaves of God, we're free to be great citizens. Like Peter could be talking about Nero in verses 13 to 17. Nero, who would drill holes in the heads of the Christians and fill it up with molten metal. Submit to Nero. Show yourself to be a great citizen, even though people will slander you for your faith in Jesus. Even though they might do the most horrendous things to you, submit to those authorities over you. They'll see something about how great a citizen you are, about how you love your neighbours and how you care for your community, that will then silence their slander, Peter says. See, how was Jesus before the authorities over him? What did he look like before Pilate? He was silent, submitted himself to death on a cross. In fact, if you read church history, it was this that had the biggest impact on the growth, one of the something like this that had a significant impact, I should say, on the growth of the church in the early centuries. Because as the Romans saw how the Christians, despite being persecuted, endured for their faith, and more than that, how it was the Christians who, despite being persecuted by their Roman culture, when there was a famine or a disease in the cities, it was the Christians who went in and loved people and cared for the sick and died as a consequence, that caused many in the Roman Empire to say, those people are better than us. And was probably something significant in the movement of Christianity becoming accepted in the Roman Empire. When God is big, you can be a great citizen. Beautiful, imperishably beautiful. When God is big and people are small, well, slaves are able to endure suffering even if it's unjust. Now, you might have a question about slavery here. That's a bit of a question. Peter's not endorsing slavery. There's lots of reasons to say that. But if you want to ask a question about that later, I think he's talking of our closest thing in our culture would be employer-employee relationship. And Peter says, when your employer treats you badly for your faith in Jesus, when you don't get the promotion because you say, I'm not going to work Sunday because I want to be with my church family, or I don't know what it might be. Peter says, that's honourable if you do that, conscious of God. It's very difficult, that. Very difficult. A good friend of mine, when I lived down in Cambridge, was treated really, really quite badly by the people that employed him. And we would meet for coffee, and I would be a sympathetic ear, listening to this very difficult situation. And he would speak about how bad this employer was, and I would agree with him, that's bad, and all the rest of it. But I remember one meeting that we had together. We went for coffee, and he'd just come from meeting another Christian in the city, who he'd gone to explain his plight to, looking for the same sympathy that I was giving. And this friend listened patiently to him for ages. But right at the end, towards the end of the, after he'd finished sort of explaining what had happened, just said this to him. I won't say his name, because some of you probably know him. He said, look, Johnny, why are you so unwilling to be wronged? And that question was the point at which everything changed in that situation for him. Why are you so unwilling to be wronged? Have you not met Jesus? The one who had every right when Pilate said, do you not know, well, that famous, do you not know that I have the power to release you or to kill you? What does Jesus say? The only power you have is what's been given to you. Like with a blink of his eye, he could have taken Pilate out, couldn't he? Click of his fingers, the Roman Empire destroyed by the majesty and the power of God's king. But he was willing to be wronged because he entrusted himself, says Peter, to God. So that colleague that treats you really badly in the office, are you going to join in the slander of them with other colleagues pulling them down? Or are you going to seek to do good to them? Look at Jesus, the perfect citizen. That's your imperishable beauty, says Peter. How did he respond to the threats, to the reviling, to the accusations? Silence. Didn't threaten. He entrusted himself to his Father who judges justly. He was gentle. He didn't insist on his own rights, though he had great rights to insist on. He was quiet before his accusers, entrusting himself. Not because he enjoyed suffering, but because he was getting to the point where he could say of those people, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. There's the model citizen. And look at the results of that submission, as Andy prayed earlier. The rescue of the whole world. That's not just him being a doormat, being walked all over. It's him going, "No, I trust my Father. This is his will for the good of the world." It's beautiful. It's imperishable beauty, isn't it? So if Jesus didn't insist on his rights, who do you think you are to insist? He's the paradigm of what honouring a hostile culture is to look like. It's challenging that, isn't it? It's penetrating. How do you speak about politicians? How do you speak about politicians? The horrible Tory government. How do you speak about your boss or your colleagues? From the public to the workplace, we're to honour Jesus. We're to present, put him on, show him off to the world because we fear God. But it's not just the public and then the workplace, but he goes right into the family home next, doesn't he? And here's where it gets difficult for us. Because when God is big and people are small, husbands and wives can fulfill their God-given roles even when their spouses don't believe. Now, verses 1 to 6, particularly, he has wives he wants to talk to. And I'm sure there are some questions about this that we can talk about later. But Peter says, wives, submit to your own husbands. Notice first, please, men, he doesn't say submit to all husbands or submit to all men. He says submit to your own husband. But what does that submission look like in verses 1 down to 6? Well, you might read through this, as someone said to me already this morning, that should I come to church in a bin bag? Is that what Peter is calling you wives to do? To stop adorning yourselves, to come here in a bin bag, don't get dressed up, don't wear nice jewellery, turn me into some 1950s housewife. That's sort of grey or brown or mundane and boring, that has no sort of self. Is that what Peter is asking you to do this morning? Well, no. I don't think that's what he's asking you to do. Rather, what he is asking you is this question. What is it that you want the world to notice about you? That's the question he's asking you this morning. He's not saying go and find the blandest thing from Asda instead of the nice things from John Lewis or wherever it is that you might go. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, what image do you want people to have of you? What do you want to adorn yourself with? What do you want to put out there? What pictures on your Instagram or your Facebook are you going to put on that betray who you are? Outward appearance is important, Peter thinks. But your beauty is to be shaped by your relationship to Jesus and being like him. Gentleness here is not kind of a doormat kind of walk all over me gentleness. No, gentleness is like we've already seen. It's like Jesus, not insisting on your own rights, not pushy or selfishly assertive. Quietness is not, I can't speak. No, it's someone who quietly trusts in God and, well, God delights in being trusted. That's what Jesus was like, gentle and quiet in spirit. We've just read that, haven't we? It's not don't buy jewelry. It's dress like Jesus. Put on Christ-likeness. This is your unfading beauty. This is who you're to look. This is who you will look like forever. But it's not that beauty and that glory comes later. Just flick back to chapter 1. Do you remember this from your Bible studies? This week, if you're in community groups. Verse 7. These have come so that your proven genuineness, so these struggles and trials, this suffering, this has come so that the proven genuineness of your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. And I think praise, glory, and honor there is our praise, our glory, and our honor. Connected to Jesus, we will be glorious. And you need to know that your faith, your imperishable faith in Jesus that will result in praise, glory, and honor is more precious than gold, he's told us. So why would you dress up in jewelry? Why would you make that the thing that you want to show off to the world, the thing that defines you, that that sums you up before the world? Put on Jesus. Like, just talking to wives, like, this is not about pulling women down, this passage. It's not about that. It's like everyone else in this passage, find your glory in taking up your cross and following Jesus. Particularly if your husband doesn't believe the word. But it's for all wives. But here it's, in the light of a husband who doesn't believe, look like Jesus in front of him. It's not about being pathetic. It's not about being a doormat. It's not about being walked all over. No, it's about being gentle and quiet like Jesus, whose gentleness and quietness wasn't pathetic, but gloriously beautiful and astonishingly courageous. Now, you might have, there's lots of things, particularly if you're in that kind of relationship, you might want to come and talk to me afterwards about how this might work out in your particular situation. Love to do that. Can't do it all now. But do you see the point? As Jesus laid down his life, he wasn't a doormat. He didn't lack value. No, it's for the salvation of the world. And I think that submission will work out differently between marriages, depending, like, how that submission works out will look different according to the situation. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all. It certainly doesn't mean, I don't think, the 1950s housewife, if that's what's in your head. Certainly doesn't mean that. But neither, and this is where it gets under our skin, as we look down on the 1950s and assume that they were really bad people. I'm sure there were some wonderful marriages in the 1950s. Doesn't mean be like that, but neither does it mean the 21st century of self-centeredness in marriage, where my marriage is only flourishing if I'm getting what I want and my needs are being met. It's neither of those things. Peter doesn't honour the 1950s, but neither does he honour the 21st century selfishness. No, he says, be like Jesus in both those cultures, those situations. See, we're not to despise or reject unbelieving spouses. We're not to make the household climate one of hostility, like as citizens, as slaves, but to fear God. And to the degree that you're able to live out your Christianity within your marriage, do that, even if it's difficult. It's not just wives, and husbands, don't think just because you only get one verse that this is not difficult for us as well. I actually think, you can ask about this later, the reason wives get so much is because Peter really wants to honour women in his letter, but that's a separate issue. You can talk about that if you want with me afterwards. No, husbands, you don't get away. Husbands, in the same way, verse 7, be considerate as you live with your wives. It sounds patronizing, doesn't it? I can imagine for us with our Western mindset in the 21st century, wives, that sounds, oh, husbands, you just be considerate to the weaker partner. That's not what Peter's tone is at all. Literally, the word considerate translates, live according to the knowledge of your wife. The weaker element there is, most commentators think, is probably to do, mostly to do with physical strength rather than it's nothing to do with being morally weaker or intellectually weaker or spiritually weaker. It's none of those things. Probably just simply to do with physical strength. It might have something to do with Peter's situation and the culture of authority, maybe, but most people think it's to do with physical strength. So Peter's saying, treat her as this physically weaker partner, even if she isn't, even if she can out-bench press you, treat her with honour and protect her and cherish her. It's what we're being called to cherish her. And I think probably Peter is talking to husbands with unbelieving spouses as well. I'll come on to that in a minute, why I think that. But for now, cherish her and live in the knowledge of who she is. So husbands, do you know your wives? I don't mean do you know what her hobbies are or how she might take her tea, but do you know her heart? Do you know what she's afraid of? Do you know what brings her joy? Do you know her gifts and her skills and her talents? And do you cherish those things? And do you want to see those things flourish in her? Do you know how she wants you to relate to her? I bet your bottom dollar how you think she wants you to relate is not what she really wants you, how she really wants you to relate. It's taken me 5 years to learn that. Have you tuned in to what she's actually saying? Have you heard her? Are you living in according to the knowledge of your wife, that you put her interests above your own? See, your role, husbands, and your position in the marriage doesn't mean treating her as less significant. No, Peter says she's a co-heir with you. She's not less significant. She's not less valuable. She's not less equal. No, don't let your position mean that you can treat her like that. No, cherish. Lift her up. I think Peter, like the rest of this passage, is addressing husbands, particularly with unbelieving wives, because you could translate as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life. You can translate that as if heirs with you of the gracious gift of life. That's one way you could write it. And I think probably that fits with the context, really, of living before a hostile world. See, in Peter's day, husbands, because of the role that they had, wives would, if a husband became a Christian or changed religion, by default, the expectation was that wives would follow. That's who they were expected, that's what they would be expected to believe. And Peter's saying, no, don't you force that on her. I think that might be what he means by living with the knowledge of your wife. If she's not believing, your role as a husband is not to force what you believe on her, but cherish her. Don't make life difficult for her. It would be easy, wouldn't it? If she's not believing and you are believing and you start to live this sort of Jesus-promoting life and then all of a sudden all of her people within her sort of sphere of life start to mock her as well because they assume, because she's not submitting to you, because she's not believing. And I think Peter's saying, no, that's not to be us. Cherish. Live in the knowledge of who she is. Treat her as if she was believing. Treat her as though she did, as though you were one in your beliefs, because that will really help her in that particular society. Oh, we could talk about that if you want after as well. In short, he's saying the same things to husbands as he says to wives. Fear God and live out your role. Submit to the role that you have in a way that honours Jesus. Live in such a way that seeks her good above your own. And don't use your physical strength or your position to crush her. Rather, cherish and delight in her. Lift her up. See, Peter wants us to see that when God is big and people are small, we're free to live lives that submit, even when that's difficult and even when that's hard. Not because we enjoy suffering. Not because we enjoy that position of being on the fringes. Far from it. It's a painful thing, as he'll say elsewhere in this letter. No, we do it because we fear God, and that puts Jesus on display. Puts him on display, living for the good of others, even if they harm you for it, because you're conscious of God, is the way that you live out the gospel. It's what makes the gospel beautiful. It's what makes Jesus beautiful. And that, because that's what the gospel is, isn't it? Jesus not insisting on his rights, not crushing a world that by rights he could have crushed, but gently and quietly laying down his life in order to rescue the world. You see, if fearing God and the love of Jesus is big in your heart, then this passage starts to become straightforward. See, to the degree that we get it is the degree to which we'll be able to do the good in this passage. The good life Peter wants us to live before an unbelieving world is a Jesus-promoting life. Not just a life that says the gospel's really true, but displays that not only is it true, but it is good and it is beautiful. And as they see that, Peter says, it may lead some to believe. More of this next week. Let's pray together.